As is customary, our first teisho of a seven-day session is on case number one in the Wu Men Guan. That's the Mu Men Kan. Zhao Zhou's dog. Zhao Zhou's Japanese name is Joshu. As has been mentioned several times, we're in the process of learning to use the Chinese names of the Tang Dynasty masters. So Mu Men becomes Wu Men, and Joshu becomes once again Zhao Zhou. The word Mu, however, we will not change to the Chinese Wu. Mu has become so much a part of our language and tradition that it simply cannot be changed without doing violence to our practice. And Robert Aitken Roshi is of the opinion that it may well have been pronounced Mu in Chinese anyway. The case reads, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, has a dog Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou said, Mu. In Wu Men's commentary, for the practice of Zen, you must pass through the barrier set up by the ancestral teachers. To realize this wondrous thing called enlightenment, you must cut off the mind road. If you do not pass through the barrier, if you do not cut off the mind road, then you are a ghost clinging to bushes and grasses. What is the barrier of the ancestral teachers? It is just this one word, Mu, the one barrier of our faith. We call it the gateless barrier of the Zen tradition. When you pass through this barrier, not only will you see Zhao Zhou face to face, but you will walk hand in hand with all the ancestral teachers in the successive generations of our lineage. You will be eyebrow to eyebrow with them, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. How wonderful! Who would not want to pass through this barrier? For this, you must make your whole body one great inquiry. With your 360 bones and joints and your 84,000 pores, concentrate on this one word, Mu. Day and night, keep digging into it. Don't consider it to be nothingness, or as being, or non-being. And don't think in terms of has and has not. It is like swallowing a red-hot iron ball. You try to vomit it out, but you can't. Gradually you purify yourself, eliminating mistaken knowledge and attitudes you have held from the past, casting away all illusory thoughts and discriminations inside and out, become one. You're like a mute person who has had a dream. You know it for yourself alone. Suddenly, Mu breaks open. The heavens are astonished. The earth is shaken. It is as though you have snatched the great sword of General Guan. When you meet the Buddha, you kill the Buddha. When you meet Bodhidharma, you kill Bodhidharma. Facing life and death, you are utterly free, and in the six realms of existence and the four modes of birth, you move about in a samadhi of innocent delight. How then should one work with it? With might and main, devote yourself to Mu, and exhaust all your life energy on this one word, Mu. If you do not falter, your mind will, like a light flashed on in the dark, suddenly become bright. Wonderful indeed. And Wu Men's verse. Dog, Buddha nature, the full presentation of the whole. With a bit of has or has not, body is lost, life is lost. Wu Men's commentary is Taisho on Mu is his the longest in the Wu Men Guan. But there's one sentence in particular that we'll take a look at today. You must make your whole body one great inquiry. You must make your whole body one great inquiry. What is this inquiry about? Katagiri Roshi writes, all beings want to know who they are. This is the natural state of everyone's heart, to seek for the knowledge of who one is. Not only human beings, but everything wants to know this. Even the tree wants to know what it is. We all contain within us a fundamental question. That question is the driving force of our very existence. It is put in many ways, but the most basic is, what am I? Not even who am I, but what am I? The who is already too limiting. What is the basic reality of my existence? If you take away Ken Morgridge, retired biology teacher, 60-plus-year-old guy with a beard, Zen student, all the flesh and bone, body and mind, is there anything left? Is there some fundamental essence that was not born and does not die, even as the physical universe itself was born and must one day die? But most of the time, we cannot bring ourselves to ask that question. So we ask it of another, the Buddha or Jesus. When people ask the Buddha, what are you? They're asking about themselves. They are asking, what am I? How can they not? We instinctively feel that maybe if the spiritual masters have indeed found the answer for themselves, somehow they can answer it for us. But that is not to be. Each of us must embrace that question, live that question, answer that question for ourselves. It's not an easy question. Nothing about it is easy. But the great tragedy of the human condition is not that we don't know the answer to that question. The real tragedy is that we don't even know that there is a question. The question gets lost. It gets buried, converted, diverted, perverted, subverted, sublimated, substituted into all sorts of other questions and endeavors. Instead of really finding that question and looking at it, who am I? What am I? We try to find an instant, easy answer. We try to answer the question without knowing what it is, or even that it is. We invent ourselves by accumulation of things, money, property, power, reputation, knowledge, enlightenment. And each time we add something, we are comforted for a while. We buy a new car, and we're comforted for a while. We earn a degree or get a raise, and we are comforted for a while. We find a partner, a man or woman, and we are comforted for a while. We find some new piece of knowledge through reading or scientific research, and we are comforted for a while. Each time we add something to that separate self, we are comforted. But the comfort does not last. Like a child who tires of the toys he got last Christmas, we ask ourselves, is that all? And we eagerly await next Christmas, the next birthday, the next raise or job, the next discovery. And when we find that the accumulation of all the stuff doesn't work, we turn to philosophy, metaphysics, revealed religion, even magic and witchcraft. The search for comfort becomes questions that might be easier to answer, such as, why am I here? Is there a God? What is good? What is evil? What is the purpose of the universe? And the ever popular, what is the meaning of life? And those answers, whatever they might be, give us comfort for a while. This is the problem with most philosophy and metaphysics. The answers, like new hats or new cars, are temporary. Our instinct is to grab the easy answer and run with it. All too often, the reason we look for answers is to get rid of the question. Huh, that's settled. Now I can get on with my life. But again, that comfort only lasts a little while. In our culture, it's the person who has all the answers who is admired. The idea of living your whole life with a question, as a question, is seen as crazy. As adults, we're not comfortable with questions. Children are. Children are always asking questions, aren't they? Why is the sky blue? Where does the rain come from? And that constant questioning drives us adults buggy. And we adults answer the questions, but we don't really answer them. We provide answers to get rid of the questions. But it is questions that keep us alive. Questions live a long, long time, even forever. Answers have a very limited lifespan. The greatest scientist that I ever met personally was a man named Per Fredriksson Sjölander. He isn't well known to the general public, but he is one of the towering figures of mid-20th century physiology. When I knew him, he was in his 70s and retired, but he still had a kind of wide-eyed, childlike curiosity about everything. One year, I spent a few months on a research vessel in the Antarctic. And during that time, Sjölander came down for a brief visit. I remember one day, we were having lunch on the mess deck. It was crab. At one point, Sjölander picked up a crab leg and turned it over in his hands and looked at it. And he looked at the little lumps and bumps on it and said, "I wonder if these spicules are part of the genetic makeup, or do they come from the environment?" I stared across the table at him, thunderstruck. How many times had I seen a crab? How many times had I eaten crab? That question had never occurred to me, and it would never have occurred to me in a million years. And at that moment, I realized that I wasn't going to be much of a scientific investigator. I didn't have the questions. Oh, I had lots of answers. Too many answers. But not enough questions. It's a rare person indeed who can survive the so-called educational system in this country and still have questions. I think the greatest gift a parent can give a child is every day when that child comes home from school to say, "Did you ask any good questions today?" It took me some 40 years of banging around in various teaching jobs and 20-plus years of Zen practice to begin to understand the value and the significance of questions. This whole issue is brought home, unexpectedly, I think, in the ancient Greek myth of Oedipus. Most of us are familiar with the story. Oedipus was the child of the king and queen of the ancient city-state of Thebes. At his birth, it was prophesied that he would kill his father, marry his mother, and bring disaster upon the city. So, in order to avoid such a calamity, his parents, King Laius and Queen Jocasta, left him abandoned in the wilderness, where he would be allowed to die of exposure. This was a custom that, in theory, absolved the parents because the child was being entrusted to the gods. But Oedipus was rescued by King Polybius of Corinth, who then raised him as his own son. But as he grows to be a young man, Oedipus hears of that same prophecy. And in order to save those whom he thinks are his parents, he leaves his foster home in Corinth to go to Thebes. What a coincidence. Now, at this point, a strange thing happens. He meets a monster, the Sphinx. She has the head and breasts of a woman, the body and claws of a lion, and the wings of an eagle. It was said that to each traveler she met, she put the same question, the famous riddle of the Sphinx. If the traveler answered it, he was allowed to continue on his way. If not, she seized the hapless one in her grasp and crushed him to death. And what was this riddle? What was this deadly riddle of the Sphinx? We've all heard it. What is it that goes on four legs in the morning, on two legs in the day, and on three legs in the evening? Every modern school child knows the answer to that riddle. And you know what? Every school child in ancient Greece knew the answer. Oedipus certainly knew it. So he gives her the answer. It's man, a human being, who goes on four legs as an infant crawling on the floor in the morning of life, on two legs as an adult in the daytime of life, and on three legs walking with a cane in the evening of life. How simple. How obvious. Having defeated the monster, or so he thought, Oedipus, inflated with his victory, goes on to a crossroads where he meets an arrogant king named Laius. The king impatiently orders the young man to stand aside, and in a sudden fury, Oedipus kills him. This may be the earliest known incident of road rage. And guess who King Laius was? His own father. And so the first part of the prophecy is fulfilled. Oedipus goes on to Thebes, where he is hailed as a hero for defeating the Sphinx. As a reward, he is made king and marries Jocasta, the widow of the former king. Jocasta is, of course, his own mother. And so the second part of the prophecy is fulfilled. And later, as described by Sophocles in the play, Oedipus's world comes crashing down as one by one the terrible facts are revealed. But what of that seemingly irrelevant incident with the Sphinx? What was that all about? This monster put a question, which Oedipus answers with ease. But did he answer it? Did he really answer it? Did he even recognize the question? The real question. What was the real question? What was that question the Sphinx asked and still asks of every traveler on the road of life? What is it that goes on four legs in the morning, on two legs in the day, and on three legs in the evening? A man? What is a man? What is a woman? What is a human being? What are you? What am I? That's what the Sphinx is asking. That's the real question. But we have to recognize that question for what it is. And if we do recognize it, we must embrace it. We must begin to turn inward and seriously address that question of ourselves. Who am I? What am I? What is reality? What is Mo? And that questioning, that practice, begins to change us. It changes us before even any recognizable insight is attained. With this practice, this questioning, we become a little more thoughtful, a little more careful. We aren't quite so cocksure about things, a little less self-righteous. A little uncertainty is a good thing. Not only did Oedipus not see the question, his so-called triumph with that superficial answer pumped him up even more. And in his impatient pride, he is now primed. He is a cocked pistol, ready to go off at the slightest provocation. And the provocation arrives in the person of his own father. Suppose, on the other hand, Oedipus had actually recognized the question. Would he still have been the loaded weapon? Maybe not. Maybe he would have been a little more patient, more willing to move out of the way. Well, maybe I'm not the greatest. Go ahead, old man. I'll step aside. This is one thing that embracing the question does. It leads to patience, humility. Answers of the sort Oedipus gives lead to arrogance, pride, and impatience. In the myth, it is said that the Sphinx kills herself in despair. No, it was Oedipus who killed the Sphinx with his superficial, conceptual answer. He killed the mind that asks. He killed the mind that can come to awakening. He killed the awakening Buddha in himself. How sad. We do that a lot. We seek the answers to kill the question and the questioner. We make a cocoon of our answers, and eventually they become our coffin. We can change, but only through practice. But we can practice only if we see the need, if we see the question and embrace it. Lacking that, we suffer the fate of Oedipus, to run blindly into the jaws of our own self-created karma. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "Has a dog Buddha nature or not?" Zhao Zhou said, "Moo." This monk is asking a serious question, but it's not the real question. He knows there is a question, but he doesn't quite know what it is. He hasn't identified it. As we mentioned, the real question often gets changed into something else, metaphysical speculations and the like. And when we ask an unreal question, we aren't going to get a real answer. Does the dog have Buddha nature? Is there a God? What is the meaning of life? What is my purpose here? Of course the dog has a Buddha nature. All beings have Buddha nature. How could it be otherwise? Of course there is a God. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Have some milk and cookies. Well, Zen teachers don't operate that way. And Zhao Zhou has bitter medicine for this monk, and he administers it unhesitatingly. No. No. The monk didn't get the answer he wanted, which would have been only temporary anyway. He got something else. He got a priceless gift. He got a question, the real question. With that one word, mu, Zhao Zhou has stripped away everything. Dog, has not, all gone. Our monk is left with only one question, the real question. What is mu? He didn't have to worry about all that metaphysical and philosophical and doctrinal stuff anymore. All he had to do is what each of us has to do, to see mu, to become one with mu, to eat mu, sleep mu, walk mu, talk mu, wear mu, smell mu, taste mu, think mu. Step one is to recognize the question, and that it is the one vital question of our lives. Zhao Zhou gave that monk and us the question. Embrace the question. Don't try to answer it in the usual way like Oedipus did. In fact, to forestall that, I'll tell you the answer. Mu is everything, mu is nothing. Okay, now that's taken care of. Just practice mu. Practice mu with all your body and mind. Breathe mu, eat mu, sleep mu, walk mu, talk mu, live mu, love mu. Relax with mu. As a question, you must make your whole body one great inquiry. Don't look for answers to carry with you into Doksan. If the question walks into Doksan, the answers will be there. You don't have to worry. That's the easy part. Just practice with the questioning mind, not the questing mind that chases after things. Be comfortable with the question that does not look for answers. It is the questioning that leads you to the edge of the abyss. And from there, all you have to do is to step into it, and you will find yourself upheld. Wu Men says, "For subtle realization, it is of the utmost importance that you cut off the mind road." When working on Mu, answers will occur to you. This is natural. but don't get caught. The practice of mu, the breathing of mu with a questioning mind, is how we cut off the mind road. The answers that come up, or what we think are answers, are the mind road. So don't waste time noodling around with answers. Go back to the question. That's the practice. Cutting off the mind road again and again and again and again and again. All the tools, mu, shikantaza, breath practice, are all aimed at one thing, that one thing. End the endless loop. Each time we become aware of wandering, following thoughts, notions, and so forth, we cut it off. Not violently, not with any notion of self-chastisement or punishment, just quietly, calmly, persistently, patiently, over and over. Come back and refocus. Practice is return to the practice. And each time you come back, something changes. However minute the change, not even discernible, but it is there. Love mu for itself. Take care of mu with every breath, every moment. Together with all beings, we realize Buddhahood.